Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs. I am joined by my co-host, Natalie Bellini. And in this episode, we want to talk all things ATTD. We were both at the conference last week, which was in Amsterdam. That's right, the Netherlands. So this is a huge international diabetes tech conference, where the programming is spectacular. The exhibit hall has all of the latest tech. And so we want to share kind of some of the big highlights with you, starting with actually Control IQ Plus from Tandem in type 2 diabetes. So Natalie and I both had the pleasure of being in the room when the results were read out. And then they were simultaneously published in New England Journal of Medicine. So that was pretty exciting, to say the least. So one of the things that makes this trial really unique is that this was a randomized controlled trial. And earlier this year, there were actually results from Omnipod 5, as well as a study with the Medtronic 780G in type 2 diabetes. Both of those were what we call pre-post studies, where they were on standard therapy and then they used the system and they compared the before and the after. That's great. I mean, both studies showed an improvement that helped the Omnipod 5 get the indication for type 2 diabetes. One of the things that makes this trial even greater is the fact that it is truly a randomized controlled trial where about one third of the participants were used their standard therapy, which for most of them was, using multiple daily injections. And then the other two thirds were randomized to the Tandem with the Control IQ Plus algorithm. And the primary endpoint was the change in A1C, which dun dun dun. The change in A1C was greater, meaning a greater improvement in the Control IQ Plus group. So it was decreased from a baseline of 8.2% to a final of 7.3%. So a 0.9% improvement. The control group improved from 8.1% to 7.7%. So they did have a 0.4%. And I think this is important to highlight why we have control groups, or why those trials are even stronger, is that naturally, when someone is coming into the clinic more often, they're meeting with the research team, they're getting all of this attention, their numbers usually improve. We see drops in A1C. And so it's not surprising that that group improved. And so to see the actual effect from the treatment, in this case, the Control IQ Plus algorithm, we see even compared to the control, there was a greater improvement, 0.9% versus that 0.4%. So, Natalie, what do you think about this?
I am so excited. So, part of the challenge is we are using Tandem in people with type 2 diabetes, but we've talked about this challenge before, right? Medicare won't cover DME pumps for people with type 2 diabetes. And we're hoping that this will push that shift because we are seeing people with, type 2 diabetes need insulin. You would think that this would be rocket science, but they do. It's a progressive disease. And even with these amazing GLP-1, GIP analogs, we see SGLT2 inhibitors improving A1Cs. We have a lot of people, especially when they come to endocrinology, who truly need insulin, and insulin pumping and AID is the answer. So we I think this is going to be great for the company to be able to go and talk to people about the use of Tandem pumps with type 2, as that hopefully that indication happens. We need an indication for type 2 diabetes, but this study will help get that. So that's number one. Our practice was part of this trial, and I can tell you, we did not, some of the things are like, do we have to use grams? Do we have to do whatever? Did for several of the patients, we did small, medium, large, put in this, put in this, put in this, right? Like, do it this way, do it this way, put in 20 grams at every meal. Nope, we need a little more than that. Put in 40 grams at every meal. And we got really great data out of being a with this pump, using it with people with type 2, right? I think sometimes we all think, okay, type 2 needs a only a only a tubeless pump. And that's just not true. This trial proved time and time again that these people with very high, some of them A1Cs, really can get to goal, and they loved it. So I was excited. I'm excited about it. And I'm hoping that long term, this gives better coverage and coverage for the use of type 2s in this pump.
Yeah, I think it's very exciting. And they also had a pretty diverse population, too. Yes. I mean, there are 319 participants in total. Like you said, you know, not actually a lot of people were not carb counting. They were able to do these kind of estimates, and that worked just fine. Also, when they presented the data, I mean, a lot of people weren't like even bolusing that much. So, and they still have these great outcomes. And part of that may be because of the auto correction feature. So every hour, if someone's above their target, if they're predicted to go over 180, they will get this automatic correction, which really helps to drive it down. In addition to the A1C, which I know was the primary outcome of this trial and often is, probably because the FDA likes to see A1C, but they, of course, also looked at time in range as well. And so the time in range did increase very nicely. So in the group, the Control IQ Plus group, it went from 48% to 64%. And then in the standard therapy group, it went from 51 to 52%. So it actually, interestingly, even though they had a drop in A1C, that mean time in range really didn't change much. So I think that's pretty interesting.
And I think we all need to remember what every 5% increase in time in range reduces complication risk, right? Reduces some, we have some data on that. So, you know, this is significant. This is exciting. It was like standing room only, applause, right? This was, we're all very happy with this data. And I love it partly because lots of people weren't bolusing, right? So the one of the differences in the tandem algorithm is that it uses that sensitivity factor. And so they can tighten that. They can make it a little more aggressive for those people and really get pretty tight numbers with little or no bolusing. I remember talking to Dr. Laurel Messer about this. She's like, yeah, you know, so what, a huge percent of the population wouldn't bolus for a whole week at a time, you know, and they could still dial in those numbers really well. And that is a wonderful thing, right? Because ultimately getting that time in range up, that increase in that time is going to reduce complications. So I was thrilled with the readout. I really was.
Yeah. And then one other thing I just want to comment on is they did have a lot of people taking SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists. And kind of similar to what we saw like with the Omnipod 5 data, those patients on those therapies also did very, very well. They had similar improvements compared to those not on those therapies. So I think it's just really reassuring that insulin pumps go together very well with all of the standard therapies used in type 2 diabetes. And this inspired me. And I had a patient today in clinic who, you know, has had type 2 on mealtime insulin for a while. And I think someone in the past that honestly, like I haven't brought up the pump. And I think I kind of assumed that it might be, it just might be too much. But today, after seeing all of this amazing data, I said, I'm going to bring it up. And I did. And naturally, one of our first thoughts was, well, wait, isn't pumps like that's for the more serious, the more severe diabetes? That does that mean like I failed, like I'm not getting off? And I was like, no, I was like, it is just another way to deliver insulin. And it may be easier and more convenient.
Right. It might take away burden. We might actually make you feel better. You might love it more. Right. Exactly.
Right. So, So anyway, she's going to think about it. And I gave her some resources to look more into it. But I think this is really, these studies are game changers. And I think we are hopefully will all become more comfortable offering it to our patients with type 2 diabetes. And we'll also see better coverage and hopefully indications for the other pumps for type 2.
Absolutely.
So,
okay.
Great. Well,
what do you want to do next? What's our next topic of ATTD?
I want to talk about some Ting.
Ting. So let's talk a little bit about Ting. So I attended one of the pre-session meetings, and this is a very hot topic. I have been contacted all over from every different patient groups, from different clinicians. How do you feel? What is this? So there is data that shows that people who spend more time between 70 and 140 have a reduction in complications versus more time between that higher group of 70 to 180. Especially if they spend more time between that 140 to 180, right? So there is data that says, and we're approximating this, none of this is written yet. None of this we know for sure what the data, what the actual suggestions are going to be. But because it's been already put out there and blown up on the internet webs, we have to talk about this, right? And ultimately, what we've found is that time between 70 and 140 or even 63 and 140, and that is really pregnancy numbers, right? If people spend approximately 50 to 55% of their time there, even if they're 70 to 180, 70% of the time, which is where our goals are now, more than 70% between 70 and 180. But if we break it down even further and we get to 50, 55% between 63 and 140, that is also demonstrates a reduction in complications. The patient groups around this are like, I'll never get there. I'll feel like a failure, all this, all that. Well, I'm not asking, you might not ever have to look at it. Maybe it's just for clinicians to help us learn to tighten that number a little bit to say, wait, let's look at postprandial differently. Let's look at fasting differently, right? Maybe we're going to use it and have to re-educate people because people struggle with feeling like failures between 70% at 70 to 180 because 70% in America is a C. Right. And so now we're going to say 55% between 63 and 140 or 70 and 140. So there is a little bit of controversy about how to present this, who we're going to present it to. What does it really look like? Is it just adding confusion? We talked in our meeting a little bit about having it all still be green, but maybe a darker green and a lighter green so that it's still consistently we're aiming for more than 70% between 70 and 180. But let's pull it down just a little bit more. I think the best way to think about this is people without diabetes spend more than 95% of their time in euglycemia or normal glycemia, and that's between 63 and 140, right? It's more like 97% of the time. So when we did 70 to 180, when that came out in 2019, there really wasn't much AID. There was only low glucose suspend. There wasn't the technology. There wasn't the insurance coverage for CGM alone in order to us to try to dial down into getting these tighter goals, right? So I think that with AID, with more knowledge about how to make AID, I call it dancing. I can make your algorithm dance, right? I can make it do what I want it to do when I want it to do it and back it off. And you know, everyone's coming out with advanced algorithms like Control IQ Plus. Omnipod is working on a new algorithm. Like they're all, you know, Medtronic has another algorithm. You know, they're all working on making their algorithms stronger and smarter so that we can exercise better and do this and not have lows, that we're going to be able to titrate down like that with those people. We have a lot of people who use injections who can do it. We have a lot of people today. I was demonstrating in a video inhalable insulin, right? So here's the inhalable insulin cartridge and here's the little, you know, and it opens up and some people are using inhalable insulin with AID and you put the thing in, boom, breathe, right? We're using mealtime insulin to reduce mealtime inhalable insulin to reduce that post-meal spiking, right? To tighten that curve. With blood pressure, we know what normal is and we treat to normal. With cholesterol, we know what normal is. We treat to normal. With diabetes, what we did was we said, what's possible in 2019? And it's different than what's possible in 2025. So I think we have to rethink what we told people because I think it was wrong. I really do. 70 to 180 is not normal glycemia. And so we really do need to think about it.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for that overview. So yeah, I mean, we have time and range right now, 70 to 180. But the TING, right, stands for time and normal glucose or time and normal glycemia.
Glycemia. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I totally agree with everything that you said. And I think I would ultimately love to see both numbers.
That's it.
That 70 to 180. Because the other area where that TING comes into play is actually people with new onset diabetes. I mean, think even stage 2 type 1 diabetes, but new onset type 2 diabetes. pre-diabetes, I'd love to see where their ting is, their time in normal glucose, because it's going to be more informative than the 70 to 180, where someone could have 100% of the time in range, but really maybe they're spending a lot more of their time between 140 and 180. And we'd want to work on really getting it below that 140. So I think it's a very
Right.
useful metric. I just think the title is what may, I'm not sure how people are going to perceive it. So prior to this, right, it was called time in tight range, which I think people had issues with the word tight. And really, if we're trying to say that this is normal glucose, then why are we calling it tight? So I get why that is not the name, why people are trying to change the name. I just think that this idea of normal versus not normal, even though it is, I guess you could say it's physiologically normal. It'll be interesting kind of how it plays out in terms of like people living with diabetes, how they feel
Right.
about it.
One of the things that was brought up was euglycemia, right? Euglycemia, right? So that's normal glycemia, right? But euglycemia, as a clinician, patients don't know what that means, right? So normal
Right.
is actually easier to some extent, right? And it's going to need some explanation, just like time in range needed explanation in 2019, right? So people without diabetes spend the majority of their time here. We add this buffer to you for time in range because we understand that we're not going to get time in euglycemia, right? All the time or normal glycemia. So it is going to be a little bit of a discussion, but I do think that there is potential to for us as clinicians to add or change medications earlier than we would have had we just glanced at 96% in range. But fastings are 140 or 160 and you still have 100% time in range. We did talk some in the group about using it. Can we eventually or one day do, and we do this already. When we're following people with stage 2 type 1, we are using continuous glucose sensing and, looking at what percent above 63 to 140 do we think it would be diagnostic to say, okay, now's the time to do a glucose tolerance test instead of making someone do one every 3 to 6 months for the until they convert. Even though that is the guideline, most of us in endocrinology who are following these positive people are, from stage 1 to stage 2 type 1 are using continuous glucose sensors when we can get them approved, as opposed to making them do all these glucose tolerance tests. So we're looking at what percent of the time would we flag to say, okay, now we need to look at the next. We do need to do more testing, right? To see if they're converting to stage 2. Right. So, which is dysglycemia, right? 2 antibody positive with dysglycemia. So, there was a lot of other things we talked about, including is 70 really low? Right. It's not. We picked it for safety reasons in 2019. And so, we'd have to redefine lows from like with the FDA because it was an adamant thing of 70 is low. But really, just like with pregnant women, we do tolerate a little bit more low, right? We do tolerate. So is 67 or 63 a better low number when we're looking at, overtreating lows a lot and having rebound highs? So again, this was the first meeting. It's all to be determined, but I think it's exciting to look at the science and where this all comes from is not let's make people feel bad. They're never going to win. Let's keep them never winning. I mean, imagine a group of clinicians sitting in a room and thinking that, right? It's like when I tell my kids, when you were young, we didn't sit up at night thinking of ways to punish you, right? Like, we don't do that. This is about reducing cardiovascular risk. This is really what this is about, is looking at this as if we see that the data shows that spending at least 50 to 55% of the time between 70 and 140 is beneficial, shouldn't I be obligated to tell you that? Just like I am about cholesterol or about blood pressure or about whatever other things we're talking about, right? Foot care or eye exams or any of it. I need to say to that person in front of me, we know this. So I think it needs to be part of the report. And then we as clinicians are going to talk more about how much we're going to dive into it, depending on the person. Sometimes I don't look at very highs at all. The first thing I look at is only lows. And if we can eliminate lows, sometimes our visit is all about that. And I then the next time we're going to do something different, or the next time we're going to do whatever, or the person's actually taking their medications at the right time and the right dose, and they've done it for two straight weeks, we're celebrating completely differently. So I think if we build it into the report and use it as needed, I think that's the best answer. And I don't think that anyone, you know, there's just been this huge backlash. And I don't think that anyone in that meeting thought, wow, we're really going to upset, you know, all these people. It was, wow, we have data that says we can improve outcomes if we do, if we look at the report differently, right? It was all within the right reason. And so I think people have to give us a chance to do it well before they start jumping off. I don't know who let this cat out of the bag. Like, I think I told you and no one else, right? And now I'm getting people like podcasters and patient groups contacting me saying, what do you know? And this is what I know. And this is what I believe. I believe we owe the people with diabetes the truth. And so then we move from there.
Yeah. Well, you gave me an idea. So, I mean, technically the pregnancy range, that 63 to 140 is really like the physiologic range. And we're aiming for that because in pregnancy, we want as near normal glycemia as possible for the health of the baby and the mother. So it would be so convenient if that range was actually the same as this, like, quote unquote, tight range or normal glucose range. And right now, one of the ways it's referred to is like TIR with like a small P, time in range pregnancy. But what if that P could stand for time in range pregnancy or physiologic? Like, that's just the physiologic like levels. I just think physiologic might, I mean, it's still, I guess it could be a complicated word, people. Yep. But it's like, I just think this normal word, even though normal is not a bad word, it just has these tones like, well, if I'm not in that range, then I'm not normal. And I don't want people to feel that way just because they have diabetes. They're not normal. So,
right. Well, their glucose isn't normal.
It's not.
Right. But we could do TIRP if for time and range for people. And leave it at that, because people without diabetes, right, that is their time and range. And the 63 is being considered. It would have to go through the FDA to redefine hypoglycemia. And that will be a longer term, right? Because FDA defines 70 and then 54. And so we would have to redefine hypoglycemia with the FDA, which will take a longer period of time. I think we're picking between, no one likes time and tight range. Everyone squirms with tight because it sounds like you're putting me in a box. And I don't like that, right? And it was interesting because some of the people in the room who had type 1 agreed to normal range and some agreed to euglycemic. And there was a psychologist in the room. And the psychologist is like, first, we need to define the science. And then we can call it what we need to. Everyone's focused on normal or tight or, you know, or euglycemia or whatever. How about if we just start with the science and then pick the acronym later, right? So I think that we have to be very careful as to first start with the science and say, this really does make a difference, right? And get that out. And then we can define how we're going to do it later, because we can think about it. We're going to meet again. We're going to do all those things. But we have to convince people and talk about why we're saying this, as opposed to calling it something like, who cares what the label is, you know? So I think that we have to balance that to make sure that we're in the same, that we're in the medical, like the science matches it, right? And then we can decide how to label it, whether you're going to call it normal with your patients and someone else is going to call it whatever. It might just be two different colors green on your download. So you might get to call it whatever you want.
It could be time in range one, time in range two. I mean, I agree with you. I think we're all on the same page about this needs to be, this is important. We should be looking at it. Outcomes are related to this. It matters. I agree. Like the name, I mean, and that could be big and then change a year later.
Right. And it might be time in range one and two, right? And that way we look at it, you know, and I think that's the hardest part. People are like really stuck on the name, and it's like, let's get stuck on the science behind it. Yeah. And then we can decide on what to call it. And if they'll just change the two colors in my, I might, again, I'll address it with the people that need it at the time. But what it does do, you guys, because I'll look at it, I've been looking at time in tighter range or euglycemia or normal range or one and two for a very long time. I'm very interested in it. It does make me change doses of things that I might not change. It really does. It changes your clinical, because in some of your CGM reports, you can, like in, I'll just mention it, Dexcom lets me do 70 to 140 or 70 to 180. So I can flip between the two. Sometimes I'm in an appointment with someone and I'll flip between the two and I'll say, look at this, now look at this, right? So this tells me that if we gave you a little bit more insulin before you ate, a little bit sooner, a little bit whatever, we can do this. It tells me that only you only spike with higher carb meals. So we can either give you medicine or we can just spread those carbs out a little. Like, it really does, as a clinician, help me. So I think my biggest thing is like, wow, the science is there to do this. And then we create the next step once we have a, once we get the science discussion out there. There's going to be a ton more ADA. You guys have to come to ADA in Chicago. Please meet us there, because we'll be reporting from there, and we'd love to talk to people about how they feel about it. We should like start a poll while we're there and just see where people feel, because it's a very emotional discussion.
For sure. Yeah. And there is so much more I want to talk about from ATTD. So I'm realizing we are definitely going to need to do at least one other episode. So we will do that. So everyone stay tuned for that. But as of now, that wraps up this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. And we hope you will tune in for the next ATTD and our other episodes. Thank you.